Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, I'm joined by Stefan Schweide and our guest, Saurabh Vishnubhakt, who's a professor at Texas A&M Law School. He does patent law, and we're going to look at the current regime for questioning the validity of patents in the wake of the America Invents Act and recent Supreme Court decisions. Interesting stuff. We'll try and find some comedy in the patent arena. We'll find it more likely in blimps and drones and poop emoji, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Matt Curtis, and Stefan Schweide. Episode 430, recorded August 17th, 2018. Samsung's Lonely Ice Rink. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thank you so much for joining us here on This Week in Law. We're very excited to be with you this week. There has been a lot of interesting developments in the patent field over the last, well, really over the last several years, but definitely over the last Supreme Court term. And we're going to go deep on that today. We've got a great resource to be able to do that. Our wonderful guest, Saurabh Vishnubhakt. Hello, Saurabh. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back, Denise. Thanks.
Saurabh is a professor of law at Texas A&M University. What are you teaching at Texas A&M these days, Saurabh?
Well, patent law I teach every fall, and I'm excited to be doing that again this fall. I also teach civil procedure and remedies.
Wonderful. We're very fortunate to have you. Thank you so much for your time today. Also joining me is my co-host, Stefan Schweide. Hi, Stefan. Great to see you.
Great to see you again.
Welcome to your first official show as official co-host of This Week in Law. Yay! We're very thrilled to have you.
Very excited to be here. And with my newfound fame, I don't know how I'm going to manage it yet, but I think I'll be okay.
Yeah, we'll pull you back to earth if your head starts getting too big. Stefan is an attorney at the Dorsey & Whitney firm in Seattle, Washington, where he is a litigator who focuses on technology and intellectual property issues. He also contributes to their wonderful blog, thetmca.com. So great to have you. And let's get into this patent stuff, shall we? All right. So, Saurabh, you're going to need to set the stage for us, I think, as to what the patent law landscape looks like from a very high level before we jump into the particulars, because there's been a lot of going back and forth, both in the courts and in Congress, about how patent law should work over the last several years. We had the America Invents Act that was passed, and we have this new body that's the PTAB. What does that stand for again?
That's the Patent Trial and Appeal Board.
Patent Trial and Appeal Board that has been working away per the America Invents Act. And now we've got a couple of decisions out of the Supreme Court this year that also impact how that's all supposed to work. So can you please describe for us, we know that we've got an office of the United States government that people apply to get their patents, then what happens?
Well, so I think the last 7 years and a number of years prior to that, and leading up to the America Invents Act, could be summed up as a fight about who gets to decide in the patent mm-hmm. system. So mm-hmm. the Patent Office issues patents, and it's actually the Patent and Trademark Office, right? So they're in charge of trademarks as well. But on the patent side, once a patent issues, historically, it was mostly the courts, the federal courts that would decide that the office had gotten it right, gotten it wrong, the patent had been violated, here's how we redress all of that. That used to belong to the courts. Now, over the last third of a century or so, and much more in the last 7 years, it's the Patent Office again, in this new body, the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, that gets to take a second look. So instead of going to court, instead of having to go to court, you can go to the agency instead And the idea there is that the agency has more expertise, more familiarity with patent law. It's cheaper and faster and hopefully more accurate if the agency does it. And so the idea is to have this expert agency be the arbiter of the validity of patents. The courts still decide whether a patent has been infringed, if money is due or an injunction, but the validity question, Congress really wanted the agency to take a strong and sort of close second look to it. So that's ultimately what a lot of the fights have been about. Because if you go to the agency and it's a lot cheaper, then the field of people who can challenge patents gets bigger, right? And from the perspective of the technology implementer community, maybe that's a good thing because lots of people are affected by patents directly or indirectly, and only a small subset of them used to be able to go to court. Now a much greater share of them can go into the agency. From the standpoint of patent owners, this is maybe not so good because the field of potential attackers upon your property rights just got bigger, right? So you used to be able to enjoy a lot of due process protections, procedural protections in court, and those aren't the same, or in some cases don't even exist in the patent office. So that's what a lot of these fights over the last several years have been about.
Are there any data or statistics that have looked at whether a court is more likely to invalidate a patent or the PTAB is? Is there any advantage to being in either venue depending on what your aim is?
Absolutely. So some of these things are, let me tell you first that there's a lot of data on this, and it's important to be careful how we interpret it, right? As is always the case with data. So in the courts, there are a number of hurdles you have to jump through in order to even get there. One, you have to show that you are at imminent risk of being sued or you've already been sued. And that's why you're coming to the court to try and fight about patent validity. If you want to go to the agency, you don't have to show that. There's no standing requirement. As far as the sort of presumption that the patent gets, that it's valid, once the patent office issues this legal right, courts will assume that it is valid, and anybody who wants to invalidate it has to show what's called clear and convincing evidence, right? It's a high standard to invalidate the patent. There is no such presumption in the patent office, in the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, and so it's much easier. And in fact, it's designed to be much easier. The idea is we have to make it easier to invalidate all patents in order that patents of poor quality can be more easily found and weeded out. We can't selectively make it harder to invalidate just bad patents because we don't know where the bad patents are to begin with. If we did, this whole thing would be unnecessary. So as a result, there's a lot of collateral damage on what patent owners would consider good patents, right? My patent is a good one. I'm not what this system was intended to weed out. And so there's a lot of sort of disparity between the standard you have to show in the court and the standard you have to show in the agency. So much more likely that a patent could survive a second look if you're in the court, much more likely that a patent will fall if you're in the agency.
Okay, Stefan, do you have any sort of big picture how the patent process, patent validity review process works before we get into talking about the recent Supreme Court stuff?
Yeah, a big picture, a major difference from the perspective of practitioners as well as clients is that when you get into the PTAB, it's like you're rushing right into summary judgment without any discovery, without any of the preliminary. I mean, there's a little bit of sort of quasi-discovery, I guess, but you're getting right into the heart of the matter, which sounds really appealing from an efficiency standpoint, and I think it is. The flip side of that is you haven't had a chance to really marinate in the subject matter for as long, and you may not be making your best arguments because you haven't been living with the patent for as long, and the quality of the briefing, the quality of the thought that goes into it may suffer. Not necessarily, but it could. And so I think anyone who's ever litigated a patent case in district court knows it takes a long time, and you spend a lot of time internally debating the merits of the patent and thinking about ways to either attack or defend it. And that is really compressed in the PTAB. And so the efficiency gain of the PTAB procedure also has a cost on the end of both the patent owner and the attorneys who are working on the briefing, they really have to get to the point right away, and it adds a challenge.
One other big picture question for you, Sarab. People who are not lawyers may not know that patent is a very particular area of law, in that I think it's the only area where it has its own bar exam. You, in order to become a patent attorney and a member of the patent bar, you not only have to pass the regular bar, you have to pass a special bar that is designed to make sure that people practicing patent law are very conversant in the highly technical issues that those cases are going to involve. Is there any, does that requirement carry over to the PTAB? Is there any loosening of that in any of this process anywhere? Or are you still, you know, you have to be part of that patent bar in order to engage in that kind of practice?
Yeah, so you do have to be a part of the patent bar in order to engage in PTAB practice, just as you would in order to represent an inventor trying to get a patent in the first place. So as you said, you have to pass this special exam. And in order even to be able to sit for it, you have to demonstrate technical proficiency, right? Usually the way you do that is to say, I've got an undergraduate degree in a science or engineering field. I think there's something like 36 college majors, each of which the patent office has spelled out. So if you have a degree in chemical engineering, biomedical engineering, physics, you know, and so on down, if you have one of those degrees, then you're all set. If you don't, then you can demonstrate technical proficiency some other way, work experience, graduate training. But whatever the case is, you have to do that before you can even sit for the exam. You have to pass the exam before you can represent inventors or represent patent owners or challengers in the PTAB. So far as I know, there's no loosening of that requirement because this is so technically salient.
Okay, so define for us what inter partes review is and what is the current kerfuffle about it?
Sure. So there are, in addition to the sort of broad strokes of PTAB practice that I mentioned, there are really three important features of inter partes review. Inter partes just means between two parties. So it's adversarial. It's intended to be a substitute for litigation. Much as you would have two parties duking it out in court, now you have two parties duking it out in the patent office. And the sort of three big features of it, one is that it only applies to certain kinds of legal arguments. So a patent, in order to be issued, has to satisfy all sorts of requirements, subject matter eligibility. The invention has to be new, it has to be not obvious, it has to be useful, well-enabled, well-described, and so on. In inter partes review, you can challenge only two of those grounds. You can say the invention was not actually new, or if it was, the invention was not non-obvious. Somebody, you know, with a reasonable amount of skill in the field could have figured this out pretty easily, just tinkering on their own. Those are the only two grounds on which you can challenge a patent, even though there may be other things wrong with the patent. So it's limited in that regard. And you're only allowed to use certain kinds of evidence, old patents, printed publications. Those are the sorts of things that inter partes review is concerned with. Another, and this is particularly controversial, is that it applies retroactively. So inter partes review was created in 2011 under the American Invents Act and went into effect a year later in September of 2012. But it doesn't just apply to patents that issued afterwards, so that people, patent owners, were on notice that, you know, if we get a patent, it might be subject to inter partes review someday. Even people who had gotten their patents years and years ago, before inter partes review was ever the law, may nevertheless be brought into the PTAB and people can challenge their patents. So this retroactive application is very controversial because the idea is that, you know, the ground has shifted under our feet and Congress is doing something or has done something that's unfair to patent owners.
And then is inter partes review the only thing the PTAB does, or does it do other things too?
It's not the only thing, but it is the thing the PTAB does most of. So there are three proceedings. One is inter partes review. One is covered business method review, which is you can make all sorts of legal arguments, but it's only applicable to patents that cover certain kinds of business methods in the financial services industry, because that was an industry, a technology area that was judged to be particularly prone to patent quality problems in the congressional findings. So that's a second type. And then post-grant review is a third kind. That applies only prospectively to patents that have issued since the AIA went into effect. You can make all sorts of arguments, all the legal arguments that are available. So there's no subject matter restriction. There's no legal sort of argument restriction, but you can only use it for the first 9 months after a patent has been issued, and it doesn't apply retroactively. So that third post-grant review proceeding is actually the closest in structure to what we might consider European-style patent opposition, where they test the validity of a patent after it's been issued.
So with this process in place and the ability to go back to patents that were issued long before the process came in place, is just about every patent getting challenged now? Has there been a huge uptick in that?
So there's been a huge sort of amount of usage of the inter partes review proceedings, and it sort of goes down by an order of magnitude. Till now, there have been probably about 8,000 IPRs filed since the system went online, and less than a tenth of that, maybe about 500-600 of the CBM procedures have been filed. And then post-grant review, I think it's still under 100, so in the 80 or 90 range last time I checked. And so PGRs, it's not surprising, because the patent has to be examined under the AIA, issued, found to be problematic, and then challenged, and that takes time. So as a result, there simply aren't very many of those. Inter partes review, on the other hand, the patent office didn't expect more than a few hundred in the first few years, and instead they ended up getting a few thousand. So it really did overwhelm expectations and exceed expectations. So there's been a lot of usage of it. Now, the fact that it's cheaper than court is attractive, but it's still pretty expensive. It's $12,000 was the initial filing fee, and then another $18,000 if the claim got instituted and you went forward. Plus, you have to pay attorney fees. So it's not like anybody off the street can come in and challenge these things. Anybody off the street with $50,000 in their pocket, maybe. So there's been a lot of usage of IPR, but it's not something that's just being used willy-nilly. It's just a much more affordable tool that people can use strategically to challenge patents.
And how's that going? Are lots of patents getting invalidated through this process?
So it depends on how you look at the data. I think once you examine the sort of full scope of all the things that are being challenged, then the rate at which patents are being invalidated completely is probably small. It's less than half. You hear about these 70-80% kill rate statistics. Those aren't wrong, but it's important to be clear that those refer to the share of patents on which review has been instituted. Once those go forward, 70 or 80% of those patents end up being found invalid. But that's to be expected. And the reason for that is when you file a petition saying to the patent office, I would like you to reevaluate this patent's validity and invalidate it, please. What the petitioner has to show is that there's a reasonable likelihood of success with respect to at least some of the claims, right? At least one of the claims. If the PTAB finds that there is a reasonable likelihood of success, and then the patent ends up being invalidated, all that means is the patent office did a pretty good job of screening and didn't take on a bunch of unmeritorious claims at the front end, right? So if they were instituting very frequently, and then the invalidation rate, the ultimate invalidation rate, was down at 20 or 30%, that means they're not doing a really good job of screening up front, and they should get better about it. So the high invalidation rate subject to institution makes perfect sense to me. The real question is what other factors are driving the invalidation rate, and things like no presumption of validity, and the fact that until recently the patent would be construed very broadly, which made it more likely that it would be found invalid. These sorts of structural differences from the court are really what's problematic about it.
Okay, so what has the Supreme Court had to say about how this is going?
So a few things. In 2016, there was a sort of, it was very important, but it was a sort of narrow technical procedural issue, right? The non-appealability of decisions that the Patent Office makes to proceed with review. The statute says you can't, the courts can't review the decision the agency makes to go forward. The question was, how broad does that lack of judicial review extend? So that was a case called Quozo v. Lee. Michelle Lee was the director of the Patent Office at the time. That came out in 2016. And then two decisions came out from the Supreme Court this year. One was SAS Institute v. Iancu, and that had to do with a practice called partial institution in the Patent Office, which is also very controversial. It essentially allows the agency to cherry-pick claims and arguments rather than saying, yes, we're going to take this case in its entirety, or no, we're going to deny this case in its entirety. The office used to sort of chart a middle ground and say, we're going to take some arguments and not others. The Supreme Court said that's not permissible. The really big controversial case, the big fight, was in Oil States. And that the Oil States v. Greens Energy Group case was that this whole system, inter partes review, all of it, is unconstitutional. Right. So that was a pretty significant fight, and it went on for a while. And ultimately, the Supreme Court said, no, it's constitutional. So that's a very momentous decision, but it has sort of no real impact day to day because all it did was preserve the status quo.
Right. Okay. So you've written a couple of scholarly pieces on how this process is shifting the previous status quo, where a lot of this happened in the judicial system rather than in the administrative realm of the PTAB. What's your take on that? Is it good, bad, indifferent? Is it accomplishing what the AIA, the America Invents Act, wanted to accomplish?
Yeah, so I definitely don't think it's indifferent.
Okay.
The historical turn away from courts being the place where this is decided to the agency has definitely been successful. I think the AIA reflected congressional intent to do that, and people have been using it exactly that way. The rate at which they're doing that is pretty surprising. So if you think about the PTAB as, you know, a substitute forum for the courts, then let's imagine that somebody goes into court, a patent owner goes to court and sues somebody for infringement. The alleged infringer now has some options. They could, you know, quit and go home. That's probably not what they're going to do, at least if they can afford to fight. They could fight about it right there in court, or they could say to the judge, please hold the case, you know, in abeyance here while we go to the patent office and seek an opinion from the agency about whether this patent is valid. If it's not, then we will have saved the court a ton of time. So in a paper from a couple years ago that I authored with two colleagues, Artie Rye and Jay Kaysen, we found that a lot of the PTAB cases, the IPR cases in particular, follow this posture. Somebody gets sued in the court. They go to the agency in a sort of defensive posture and say, this patent that I have been sued on, I think is invalid. And so I'd like the patent office to opine on that. And this is the paper we published in the Berkeley Technology Law Journal. And what we find is that 70% of the people who go to the agency, right, these PTAB petitioners, are acting in this defensive posture. So long as the court actually stays its hand, that sounds like exactly the sort of substitution that Congress had in mind. Now, courts don't always stay their hand. They're not sure that the agency is going to tell them anything useful. Sometimes they're not sure that the agency is even going to take the case. And so there's just variation from district to district, region to region, about, you know, when it's appropriate to grant a stay. So that's one problem with the substitution. But the other surprising finding that we had was that the remaining 30%, right, the ones who aren't going in a defensive posture, what are they doing? Well, they're striking first, right? Preemptive strikes in the PTAB before you've ever been sued on the patent yourself, I think is a really interesting strategic use of the PTAB process. It's not clear to me that it was intended by Congress. Maybe it was, but it certainly wasn't unforeseeable. We just didn't expect that it would take such a substantial share of the agency's workload, that there are people coming in who haven't been sued yet, but maybe they think, you know, I've been looking out for patents that might be used against me, and so it's better if I just strike first and clear the way for myself.
Maybe so let's unpack that for a second. You're a patent owner. You know that you can be hauled into this procedure. You can either be challenged in court or in the PTAB. Maybe you get challenged in court and then it gets moved on that validity question to the agency. Right. So instead of waiting for that to happen, you go to the PTAB yourself proactively and say, hey, we've got a patent here. Take a look. Protect us.
No. It's not the patent owner who's going the agency. No, it's somebody who wants the patent invalidated. So
okay.
A patent owner would not go to the PTAB, first of all, because the statute doesn't allow them to. You can't bring your own patent in to the PTAB. The way, for example, you used to be able to do with ex parte reexamination. Mm-hmm. You know, you get the examiner to take a second look at it, and if they go through and say, yep, everything's fine here, then you just gold-plated your patent.
Right.
That's not an option that's available through inter partes review.
Okay, I misunderstood. Who is the party seeking review then?
Somebody else who hasn't been sued yet but thinks they might get sued, or who just wants to see the patent invalidated and, you know, has the money for it. So you can imagine all sorts of strategic behavior as a result of that option being available. So somebody who says, I want to use this technology, and I have a reasonable belief that this patent could be asserted to cover the technology, and although I haven't been sued on it yet, I might someday soon. If that's a conclusion that somebody reaches, they could go to the PTAB preemptively and do in the agency what a declaratory judgment suit would ordinarily do in court. This is where you go preemptively to the court and say, I'd like a declaration that the patent is invalid. Right? So people do that, and that's part of the 30%. Another part of the 30%, and I'm not, you know, we haven't broken it down yet as to who's in what particular position, but you could also imagine that somebody's in an industry where they see their other competitors getting sued by this patent owner and think, okay, well, the patent owner is going after them. There's not that much difference between what they do and what I do. And regardless of whether I think the case has merit, there's risk here. So the patent owner has tipped its hand a little bit. Let me take advantage of that information and go to the PTAB and strike first before I get sued. So whether you're out there just prophylactically screening patents or you're seeing what's going on with others in your industry, being sued, all of these are potential reasons to go to the PTAB first, and that happens to the tune of about 30% of the PTAB petitioners. So that's a substantial minority, I thought, and it was one of the more interesting findings that we came up with.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Stefan, any questions about this?
Yeah, the thing I find striking about that those examples you just gave is there's another potential scenario, and that's let's say there's an incumbent player in an industry and they've got a lot of old technology and they dominate the market, and they see one of their competitors coming up and patenting some new technology that might be a threat to their underlying business. That patent gets issued. Let's say it's a startup. Let's say it's an immature company. They can then target that patent and try to blow it up before the company gets any traction and keep their competitor out of the market by doing that. And I'm wondering whether you saw that happening in that 30%, whether you saw that kind of behavior, or whether that's something that's yet to be quantified at this point.
Well, so we definitely saw it, and anecdotally we can tell you it does happen. It remains to be quantified only because we looked at the full universe of, at that time, I think there were close to 5,000 patents, 5,000 cases that have been filed in IPR, and we were looking at all of them, so we were only able to go so deep into each case. We know it happens, but the extent to which it happens and the frequency with which new entrants are actually being forced out of the market and lost opportunities, that has yet to be quantified. in a sort of precise econometric way. But you're absolutely right that particularly when the two technologies are in potential substitution with each other in the market, this court agency substitution is being used as a strategic club to just keep people out, right? I think that's a serious problem, but I don't know how pervasive a problem it is yet.
The interesting thing about that particular problem, too, is that one of the reasons why people like IPRs in theory is that they offer an opportunity to go after junk patents. You know, everyone has heard of patent trolls, and they understand that concept loosely. But the situation where you're going after a competitor who's just trying to enter into the market and you've identified the patent before they've sued you, that's not likely to be that same kind of junk patent, because this is something that you've taken the time to identify as a possible threat to you, and you've determined that it's going to be eating into your market. So that's a very different type of patent, I think, than the kind of patent that people think about when they talk about wanting to have a cheap, efficient resolution, which is to say, you know, someone's running around asserting patents against 15 different tech companies, and that patent is very clearly in that category of sort of junk patent that everybody's heard about, where you don't find out about it until after you've been sued. If you're taking the time to identify entrance into a market and using the IPR process as a substitute for litigation, that's probably a different category of patent and may not have the same social gains in having those things invalidated without a full judicial hearing.
Absolutely. I think the narratives we hear about non-practicing entity litigation, patent assertion and all these sorts of behaviors, we often talk about these using proxies like a nuisance company that's going after big companies that have deep pockets. So in this case, the little guy is the villain, and the big guy, the deep pockets, they're just the sort of, they're trying to go about doing their business, and they're, the hapless, big money targets. On the other hand, you can imagine the David versus Goliath narrative, where the big incumbent, the entrenched incumbent, is trying to keep the virtuous startup out of the market. So here it's the big company that's the villain, and the little guy who's the hero of the story. So because those stories can be spun both ways and so many other ways, I think some of these, the value of some of these proxies starts to diminish when we get into the PTAB, precisely because it's so much easier to invalidate patents there than it is in the courts. And that means it's easier for everybody to invalidate every kind of patent. Now, it's worth pointing out that covered business methods, which are, sort of created just for the financial services industry, didn't have this preemptive strike ability written into them. So in CBM review, you can only petition for CBM if you have already been sued, or as the courts have interpreted that, if a lawsuit is imminent, right? So if a lawsuit is on the verge of being filed so that it would create Article III standing in the courts, that's enough to satisfy the I've already been sued requirement of CBM. But for inter partes review, there's no such requirement. You can just fully preemptively go in. And closing that gap might be one way to differentiate between these two sorts of behaviors that you're talking about.
Well, I think we're going to get into how Congress is seeking to fine-tune some of these processes or eliminate them altogether in a little while, because there are a number of bills pending. So let's bookmark that and make sure we come back to that, because obviously if the America Invents Act, would you say that its goal was primarily to weed out bad patents, or did it have a broader kind of policy purpose?
Yeah, I think the main change at the time for the America Invents Act was actually going from a first to invent system to a first inventor to file system, right? So that aside, on the Patent Trial and Appeal Board front, I think Congress was broadly concerned with patent quality, and the PTAB was one vehicle they were using, and particularly inter partes review, to try and deal with the problem of patent quality. So the idea was that for new patents coming out, we'd have post-grant review to ensure that once a patent's the conversation between the applicant and the inventor has concluded and a patent issues, post-grant review is there so the public can come in and immediately test whether the patent is valid or not. Because they might have different incentives than the patent examiner might, and certainly different incentives than the patent owner. Now, for all of the patents that were already out there in the world that needed to be, you know, it's not a question of future patent quality, but removing the poor quality patents that already exist, that's why IPR was made retroactive. You could, and CBM too, you could go in and weed those out because they had already taken root. So that was a different solution to past patent quality problems that we wouldn't otherwise be able to solve except through litigation. So I think AIA was broadly concerned with patent quality. It wasn't just weeding out existing bad patents. It was also to test future patents so that over time, you know, these old patents of good or bad quality are going to expire someday. And we want some mechanism in place to ensure patent quality on an ongoing basis too.
Yeah, let's explain that issue as well for folks, how patent expiration works, what the term of a patent is. It's far less than copyright term, correct?
Oh, yes, quite a bit less.
Describe how that works, what the term is, and how it might get extended.
Okay, so the term of a patent is 20 years from the date it's filed in the patent office as an application. And if it takes 3 years to issue, let's say, you know, you go back and forth with the examiner, and at the 3-year mark, the patent issues, that's when the patent comes into force, comes into effect. And you have 17 years left until your 20 years from filing runs out. If it takes only 1 year, then you've got 19 years of patent term. If it takes 7 years to get your patent, you've only got 13 years, right? So from that, you can tell the life of a patent is pretty well set the moment you file it. If you ever get the patent, the clock starts ticking and will run out 20 years from the original filing date. Didn't always used to be like that. It used to be 17 years from issuance. So if you filed it and it took, you know, however long it took, once you got the patent granted, that's when the clock started ticking, and it wouldn't run out until 17 years from the issue date. Now, that seems perfectly fair to the patent owner, but what about the rest of the world? If the patent owner keeps revising their patent while it's in examination to cover all sorts of technological improvements that are going on in the world, then that'll be a problem, because once the patent rises to the surface and becomes issued, you can all of a sudden sue everybody for things they didn't know were being placed into this patent right. And that metaphor of surfacing was something that a lot of critics of that system used. They called them submarine patents. They would lie beneath the surface, and then as soon as they rose, you could sue everybody and make millions or even billions of dollars. So that's the problem that Congress thought it was solving when it created this 20-year from filing term. Now, it can be extended, as you said. The 20-year sort of default creates some certainty that this is how long a patent will last once it's been issued. But if you, you know, have that problem, for example, of the patent that takes a long time, 6-7 years, and the ordinary patent owner who would otherwise have gotten 17 years under the old system is now only getting 12 or 13 years of term, well, they can go to the patent office and say, look, all of this unreasonable delay that the examiner incurred in examining my patent has caused me harm. And so I should be entitled to some patent term extension, some restoration, so that I get that time back on the back end of my patent. And so when you do that, and successfully, you know, petition the office for it, they will tack on some additional time so that the examiner's delay isn't held against you. It's like stoppage time in soccer, right? I mean, you want that time added back on at the end. So
is that fairly easy to get when you apply for it?
Yeah, so the rules for it are pretty straightforward. Your own delay doesn't help you at all, because that would create bad incentives. But the examiner's delay, if you can show it took longer than was reasonable, then yeah, it's pretty pretty straightforward to get that, I think.
So my last question for you, and I'll let Stefan have a crack with his last questions too before we move on to proposed bills in Congress. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering what the impact has been, if any, on the what has traditionally been the patent litigation hub of the United States, the Eastern District of Texas. What's going on there? How has this affected whether people litigate their cases there?
Yeah, so two things have happened, actually. Since the Patent Trial and Appeal Board was constituted and you know IPR went into effect, it quickly and very steadily rose to become the forum where more patent validity questions are litigated than any other forum, including the Eastern District of Texas. So mm-hmm. this is one thing that my co-authors and I found as well, that it used to be that Eastern District of Texas, Northern District of California, District of Delaware, there were a few dockets around the country that were very likely to get these cases, had procedures in place to get them sort of knocked out quickly and usually accurately in terms of judicial expertise, because the judges had taken the time to really learn about patent doctrine and how to do effective case management. So those were the places that you usually went to. Eastern District of Virginia was another one. What the Patent Trial and Appeal Board became was the even faster, even cheaper, even more expert competitor, and it's the sort of leading rocket docket for patent litigation now. And so that by itself made the PTAB the leading district. Now, people could still go to the Eastern District of Texas for questions of infringement and other things, mm-hmm. and depending on the likelihood that they got a stay, which was less likely in the Eastern District than, say, in California, the court litigation could proceed even while the PTAB was doing its work, because the judge simply said, look, I have the discretion to grant a stay or not to grant a stay, and I choose not to. So in that situation, the Eastern District would continue going on. Now, the reason people went to East Texas in the first place and were able to do that is that the rules governing venue in patent litigation were considerably more lenient than in most other types of litigation. And so the Supreme Court, in a case called TC Heartland, basically, the question was whether the patent venue statute in Title 28 of the U.S. Code really meant what the Eastern District had held it meant, and what the Federal Circuit over the past two decades or so had concluded it meant. And the answer, the court said, was no, it doesn't. It should actually be much more closely tied to things like personal jurisdiction. And it shouldn't be as easy as it is to go to the Eastern District if there are no substantial connections, no real connections between the defendants and that district. So what that means now is you can't sue in East Texas as easily anymore. And the cases that used to go to East Texas instead of going, say, to Northern California or Delaware are now going to those other districts. So a lot of this was tech companies that are headquartered in the Northern District of California. So that's where they have the most contacts. You can sue them there. Most companies are incorporated in Delaware. And so the District of Delaware would have not only personal jurisdiction, but also a venue would lie in that district. Those are the two forums where people predicted these cases would go. Michael Risch, who's a professor at Villanova, and Colleen Chen at Santa Clara, wrote a paper predicting this is where these cases are going to go if TC Heartland comes out the way the petitioner wants. And that's the way it came out, and they were exactly right. Those are the two districts where people went now.
Wow, I wonder if Texas is plotting how to compete with Delaware to be the place where corporations incorporate so that they can get those cases back.
There you go.
Stefan, any other thoughts?
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Sarah. So what I'm wondering is, your students, when they learn about this stuff, what do they find most surprising about the process of invalidating a patent? And I ask because I think most people who are aware enough about patent litigation understand that this process of invalidating a patent exists, may not understand the texture of what that actually looks like to go ahead and do it. And part of the problem there is the narrative around it is, you know, there's a junk patent and you have these technical judges and they're going to sit down and they're going to look at it and make a determination. And it all sounds very scientific. When you actually go about doing it, it's a lot more wishy-washy, I think, than people tend to understand or assume. So I'm wondering, as a professor, you're dealing with students who are encountering this for the first time. What do they find surprising? What do they find interesting about the process of actually invalidating a patent and what that exercise looks like on the ground?
Sure. So 2Ls and 3Ls, who are, you know, the students who take patent law with me, they have had civil procedure. And they've had criminal procedure for the most part. So they sort of understand due process. They understand how courts operate and what judicial process requires in order to dispose of people's, you know, property and liberty and so on. Not all of them have taken administrative law or administrative process yet. And so they aren't as familiar with the government through adjudication, the executive branch of the government through adjudication, dispensing with people's property interests and these sorts of things in a way that doesn't really have all of the formality and process that courts have. So I think many of my students would agree with you that it seems wishy-washy, and it surprises them because, I mean, a lot of administrative law is wishy-washy, and there are good reasons for that, or at least reasons that we've historically agreed to. But the idea that some tribunal that purports to do what courts do, but isn't doing it the way courts do it, how can that be legitimate? How can that be valid, right? That's the sort of tenor of a lot of the questions I get. It has a lot to do with procedure and the standards of review, that they already understand how the courts would do it in patent litigation, and now it's much easier to do it with all of these safeguards removed in the administrative agency. That's obviously something that was done by design. You know, it wasn't sort of accidentally put in place. Congress consciously created these procedures in this way. So that's what surprises them, and I have to sort of talk them through the value judgments and the priorities that Congress was trying to vindicate in taking away some of these procedural safeguards in exchange for other things that they thought were important.
Interesting. All right, we're going to move on in a moment here and talk about the legislative aspects that I've alluded to earlier in the show. But folks who listen to the show regularly know that we insert MCLE passcodes into the show. We've had a lot of good information about patent law here today. I'm learning a lot. I hope some of you are too. And if you're interested, if you're a lawyer or another professional who has a continuing legal education requirement in your field, or a continuing education requirement if you're not a lawyer, you may want to apply to whatever your oversight board is and see if this might help you get the credit that you need to meet those requirements. So we put these phrases in case your oversight board needs to have a validation that you actually watched or listened. Our first phrase for this show is going to be Aeon Flux, the sci-fi movie starring Charlize Theron, and you'll understand why in a moment. But just for now, Aeon Flux is our first phrase. And if you're a lawyer and you need more information about how you might go about applying for credit, head on over to our show's wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Find This Week in Law there. That's the show you're listening to. And we've got a chart of the various jurisdictions in the United States and whether you're eligible to apply or not, and some forms that might help you do so. What was I going to do? I was going to tell you why Aeon Flux is the first passphrase for this show. We'll put another phrase in before we wrap up. And that is, I'm not sure why this hit my radar this week, but since we're discussing patents, it would be interesting to highlight it. It's been all in the news this week that Amazon has been awarded a patent for a floating blimp warehouse, a combination warehouse slash drone delivery structure, where at 45,000 feet above the ground, Amazon is going to have, if it moves forward on this business strategy as elucidated in this patent. It would have warehouse blimps that were serviced by drones. They would move around to make it easier for the drones to fulfill orders from that floating warehouse. So it immediately brought to my mind the kind of creepy floating blimps in the Charlize Theron movie. And it just sounds like something right out of a sci-fi movie, but it also seems to be something that Amazon wants to make sure that it has patented the process for. Any thoughts, Sarab, about this patent?
Well, I, for one, welcome our new blimp overlords. I think this is precisely the sort of... I think I've seen patents like this in aeronautics before, and I think primarily what they serve is two functions. One is just option value, right? They're patenting a number of potentially promising technological research areas and development research areas so that whichever one ends up going forward and actually succeeds as a matter of commercial feasibility, that's the one they will have protected all along. So for every 10 or 15 or 100 of these that you see, maybe only one or two will eventually succeed. But simply by putting it out there, we found out about it because the application published after 18 months, and people can know a company as innovative as Amazon is choosing to invest in this. That sends a signal to investors and to other technologists that this is something worth looking into and investing in. So I think those two functions of the patent system are very valuably served here, and it's for geeks like me, it's just fun to read through them and look at the pictures. I actually didn't think of Aeon Flux when I saw this, but I should have. That's a really good...
That one was housing, I think, all the genetic information of the population. This this is just housing all of our toothpaste or whatever else you're getting delivered from Amazon. All right, let's move on and talk about legislation, regulation, and policy. So I've alluded to the fact that Congress is trying to tinker with the patent process. My very own congressman, Dana Rohrabacher from California's 48th district, has been instrumental in some of the pending bills. Why don't you tell us what's on the table, Sarab?
Sure. So the Inventor Protection Act is... So a number of the Supreme Court decisions that we talked about and the sort of pre-AIA baseline, and in some cases even earlier baselines, this legislation is intended to sort of scale back what I think a number of people in Congress perceive as the excesses, and if not the unforeseeable consequences, at least the unintended consequences of the AIA. So, for example, the T.C. Heartland decision... patent owners are no longer able to file infringement suits in home jurisdiction. As a result of that, you can go to where the defendants are, but if you're based in East Texas, you can't go there anymore. So to scale that back, you could, under this legislation, you'd get the right to bring a civil action wherever the defendant is subject to the court's jurisdiction or wherever the defendant has committed an act of infringement. So this was the interpretation of the venue statute that was already in place when T.C. Heartland was decided. The Supreme Court in T.C. Heartland said that's the wrong interpretation. This legislation takes that interpretation and codifies it into law so that going forward, it'll be unambiguous that what patent owners were already doing is now permitted. So that's one big change. Another big change is the injunction standard. So in 2006, the Supreme Court decided a case called eBay v. Merck Exchange, in which a patent owner on an online marketplace sued eBay, saying your entire structure of how you set up the eBay marketplace infringes our patent. And the question was whether a permanent injunction should be available in that case. And the Federal Circuit up until then had been saying, well, when a patent is violated, infringed, it will generally be the case that a permanent injunction should issue. because there will be ongoing harm. It won't be possible to remedy that harm simply with money, because as long as it's ongoing, you'll have to keep coming back and asking for more money each new instance of infringement, each time that comes up. So that's precisely what injunctions are supposed to do, is stop that sort of thing. And licensing agreements take place in the shadow of litigation. The only reason somebody has to come to the table and negotiate with a patent owner is that they know that if they don't come to the bargaining table, they're going to get sued and they could have an injunction levied against them. Knowing that, that credible threat is what causes bargaining to take place. If that credible threat doesn't exist anymore, then bargaining won't take place. And the Supreme Court in eBay said that the Federal Circuit had it wrong and that they shouldn't presume that that injunctions will always issue, and it should remain an extraordinary remedy. So the sort of result of that, and there's, I think, pretty broad consensus in the patent community, regardless of whether you think it was a good decision or a bad decision, that it's now certainly a decision that made it harder to get an injunction, just as a descriptive matter. It's harder to get an injunction after eBay than it was to get an injunction before eBay. So what this legislation would do is roll back the Supreme Court's decision and make it easier to get injunctions, because this legislation is animated by a position that eBay was wrongly decided.
My congressperson, who's behind a lot of these pending bills, I think there are three of them. Is that right?
I've seen two of them. Inventor Protection Act. Yeah, so 6557 and one other.
Is that RLIA, the other one?
RLIA, that's right.
Yeah. We'll talk about what that does in a moment. I'm wondering, my congressman is in a fight for his seat. He's been the congressman in our district since 1988. And this is the first time he's really faced a challenge. He's now in a dead heat for his seat in November with his Democratic opponent, Harley Rauda. Do you think that there's anything strategic about proposing these bills at this time?
There may be. I'm actually not sure what the partisan political valence of legislation like this would be. Mm-hmm. Just because, although there's, you know, ideological disputes within patent law, including in the courts and the Supreme Court, they tend not to map on so neatly to the Democratic-Republican divide as many other issues. So I'm not sure I see the sort of political calculus at work here.
These issues are pretty esoteric for your average voter to really latch onto, I would think.
Right. So there are details in the legislation, like inventor-owned patents, right? Certain patents that the inventor not only acquired the patent, but now is trying to actually commercialize them himself or herself, rather than sell it to somebody who might use it for nefarious purposes. So if there's political hay to be had by saying, look, I'm looking out for individual inventors, and you know that's who I'm sort of trying to protect, in ways that the eBay decision or the TC Heartland decision made it harder for them to vindicate their property rights, then that may get some political traction. But that too, I think, is a sort of, as you said, esoteric issue, and I'm not sure what the political dynamics are, but the legislation itself certainly has these substantive effects on the law, and it remains to be seen, you know, in this larger political environment, whether any legislation prior to the midterms will have a shot.
Isn't there a bill pending that would eliminate the PTAB altogether?
Yeah, so that's that's RLIA, the Restoring America's mm-hmm. Leadership in Innovation Act. It would remove the PTAB. It would repeal inter partes review, post grant review. It would also change a number of the sort of existing dynamics for patent examination. So, for example, I think one of the provisions I saw would remove publication of the patent application at 18 months, rather than at instead make it at grant. That used to be how patents were published over 20 years ago. So it used to be the case in the United States and in not many other countries in the world where if you filed an application, it was confidential, and it remained confidential unless and until the application was approved and became a patent. Once it became a patent, then it couldn't be confidential. It had to be published, just like title deeds to land have to be public so that people know how not to trespass on other people's land, right? So that used to be the case. Now, a lot of other countries, Europe, Japan, right, the major IP systems around the world, had a system that was different. What they would do is once the application was filed, 18 months thereafter, the application would publish. And if it ended up issuing as a patent, then you could sue people for infringement if they copied your invention. And if they committed copying of your invention while your application was pending, then after you got the patent, you could sue them for back damages that took place during the term of the patent, so long as your patent hadn't changed substantially from publication to grant. So people had noticed, they violated your rights, and now you can get money for that. But the sort of downside of all of that was that people would know what you were working on. People would know what you were patenting and where you were putting your investments and exactly what to do with your invention. So if they wanted to design around it, they could do that while your application was still pending. So that's, you know, that certainly changed the status quo against inventors. It tried to compensate them through this intervening rights, you can get back damages and that sort of thing. But I think many inventors would say that, you know, that probably wasn't enough. Some might say, yeah, that more than compensated us. But there are always going to be people who are dissatisfied with the balance that Congress has struck. Congress ultimately said it's in our interest as a society for this information to be more widely disseminated. And it's in our interest as a country to have the same set of rules that our trading partners in Europe and Asia have. So there was some sort of patent harmonization logic to that law as well. What RALEA would do is end 18-month publication and take us back to it remains confidential unless and until it publishes. Unless and until it grants. If it never grants, it remains confidential all the way through. People will never find out that this was being considered by the patent office. And so that would move the pendulum back in the other direction and take us out of step with a number of our trading partners.
Right. So that one is being proposed by Thomas Massey of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And then I guess there's another act called the Stronger Patents Act that is also bubbling out there.
Yeah, that's been around for at least a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. As I recall it, the Strong Patents Act, which was the sort of one of the predecessor proposals, and the Stronger Patent Act, don't go as far as RALEA does. Mm-hmm. What they do is sort of tweak the inter partes review procedures to change things like the presumption of validity. So you get a presumption of validity in court, you get the same presumption of validity in the PTAB. So the patent is presumed valid, it has to be shown to be invalid by clear and convincing evidence, and not merely a preponderance of evidence, right? So 5149 is enough to invalidate in the PTAB, but you need a lot more evidence in the court. So this would sort of correct those asymmetries between the court and the agency. But to my knowledge, it wouldn't sort of take the PTAB out of commission altogether. It wouldn't roll back all of these other systemic rules that the patent examination process has had for much longer than the AIA has been around. So it's a little less sort of vigorous in how far it goes after the rules.
Stefan, do you have any thoughts or questions about these potential congressional moves to either undo its prior legislation in the America Invents Act or to give stronger protection to inventors or both?
Yeah, so on the point about the applications not publishing, I want to give a concrete example of why that's significant. The the process of invalidating a patent, whether it's in the PTAB or district court, you cite what's called prior art. And prior art is just anything that was out, you know, typically it's publications, patents, or applications that were publicly available and could be found anywhere in the world and can be then asserted against against the patent in the course of invalidating it. If you don't publish applications, you essentially seal off large volumes of material that could eventually be used as prior art. And so not only do you deprive the world of the knowledge that becomes available when an application publishes, but you ultimately reduce the quality of the patents that do issue because you make it easier for those patents to survive despite the fact that somebody may have been working on that and just never finished the application, never got a patent out of it. But that knowledge really was out there. And by sealing that off, ultimately, I think you degrade the quality of patents that are going to be issuing. And so I think that's something to pay attention to. On the other act, this Inventor Protection Act, what struck me about that was, you know, Americans love to think in terms of stories and narratives. And I don't know that there's a more sympathetic national character than the farmer. And I think the inventor is kind of a close second. And politicians love to talk about individual farmers and individual inventors. And I think it just as, you know, most farming is done by large agricultural industry players, I think a lot of the real invention innovation is happening in large companies with individuals who are inventing patents and then assigning them to the companies that employ them. And I would imagine if an act like this, Inventor Protection Act, passed that gave disproportionate rights to inventors who own their own patents, we would find a way through contract to be clever about giving the companies that employ those inventors the same rights and essentially get around the intent of the act, which is ostensibly to protect inventors who own their own patents. And I know that's kind of, you know, I'm getting in the weeds a little bit here, but the premise that you could somehow create two classes of inventors, one who owns one class of inventors who own their own patents and another class of inventors who lose their protections just because they're employed by a large company who then gets ownership of the patent, that just doesn't make a lot of sense. It doesn't reflect the reality of how innovation is done, how business is done in America. And I can't imagine this being successful. And if it is successful, I can't imagine it going unchallenged in many ways. So,
yeah, so that's an interesting point, right? Some of the analysis that I've read about the inventor-owned patent definition in this legislation raises just the point that if you've got an inventor who, even if they don't work for a large company, wants to license it to a large company because the inventor's comparative advantage is inventing, right? I'm really good at chemistry. I love working in the lab. I love blowing stuff up occasionally, but I don't have a head for business. So if I want to make money for my invention, I should go to somebody who's really good at business and distributing inventions and whatever the case may be. So if I can, through contract, assign my rights to them and they'll just write me a royalty check every month, I can stay in the lab where I'm happy and competent, and I don't have to go out into the market and start my own distribution network, which I might not be very good at anyway. So the language of this legislation is a little bit unclear to me as to whether setting up a company to commercialize your invention or licensing your patent to somebody, even though you sort of remain the owner as a formal matter, whether those arrangements would be entitled to the same protection. So you're right that if they're not, that creates problems. But the sort of other problem that I foresee is that we just won't know, and that uncertainty will cause the same sorts of problems that this act was trying to solve in the first place.
Right, and the reason I use the farm analogy is you can just reading the text of this the coverage here, you get the sense that there's this sort of perfect inventor that the drafters had in mind here that they want to reward with these special privileges, just as you might want to reward, you know, the hardworking farmer who tills the land and give them all sorts of special protections. But then when you try to implement that, you realize that most farm work is being done not in this romantic way, but on a much larger scale. The premise behind the act just sort of falls apart, and it's the same thing for inventors. I mean, they're not sitting there by themselves in a lab. We're not in the 1800s here. And which isn't to say it doesn't happen. It's just, you know, come on.
Sounds like it's time for a congressional field trip to Marshall, Texas, so they can see the Samsung ice rink and the various other things that were erected there to appeal to the jury and court on the part of the patent owners who were not individual inventors.
With all due respect to your congressman.
Yes, exactly.
Just pointing out, if I may, real quick, the America Invents Act at one point introduced a new category of inventor, right? So we've always, for a long time, had the regular set of fees that you pay at the patent office and also small entity fees. So if you are a small entity, you know, defined the way the patent office defines it, then you get a 50% discount and other benefits along the way, because that's a policy choice that we want to encourage new entrants into the marketplace. The example that Stefan gave of a patent owner trying to carve out a place for themselves against entrenched incumbents, that's precisely what we want, because that's where new employment comes from. It's where economic growth comes from. There's a lot of economic research on that. The AIA created a third category of micro inventors who were entitled to a 75% discount. So even cheaper, and you know, you had to satisfy even more criteria to get there. But micro entities included individual people working in their garage or whatever, and also universities, because so much research and development and commercialization takes place in the American university. And that has, I think, in the romantic imagination and probably the political economy of the patent system, a very special place as well, because this is research we're already paying for, often through federally funded grants, and it just sits on a shelf, and that's no good. We want it to go out and be commercialized and make people's lives better. And if we can use the patent system to encourage that, we should. So that was a reason for the AIA to include large universities into, you know, this sort of incongruously named micro entity label. But I actually was a little surprised, if that's what they were trying to do in the in this legislation, the Inventor Protection Act, why not also consider the university community? Because that's where a lot of this sort of innovation also takes place.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Any final thoughts on what Congress may or may not do to alter the current patent system we've been discussing?
I think the likelihood that any legislation is going to pass is probably minimal. And although I've written, you know, a lot about what improvements could be made to the PTAB and these sorts of things, I think the current administration in the patent office with Director Iancu has already made a number of moves that I think are in the right direction in terms of changing the way patents are interpreted in PTAB review, taking another look at the patentability of life sciences innovation. All of these policy levers that the agency already has at its disposal, they're using in ways that Congress doesn't need to step in. They've already given the patent office a lot of power, and it just sort of changes from one agency leadership administration to another. So because the patent office is already starting to move in some of the right directions on these issues, and because the midterms politicize so much, I think new legislation is less necessary than it was maybe a year ago, and is probably less likely to pass anyway. So at least for the time being, we can watch changes unfold more slowly, and hopefully from people who have a lot of expertise and experience administering it.
Sounds like a good call. Any final thoughts on these patent issues, Stefan?
It's just nice to see Congress talk about grown-up topics, and even if they're getting them wrong or going in the wrong direction.
It is. No. All right. Speaking of other topics that Congress likes to take up from time to time, or may take up, a couple of new developments on the net neutrality front, since we're discussing legislation and policy. One is at the state level in California. You'll recall we've discussed on the show before that California was looking to enact its own net neutrality bill, which would replace the open internet rules that the FCC recently dismantled and that went out of effect. California proposed a bill. There's been some jockeying about it. There was an episode where the very sweeping bill that California was pushing through the legislature had been gutted in committee. That is being slowly restored. The strength of the bill is being restored. The EFF has a nice piece about how activism is affecting this. And we have a California senator. Again, we've been discussing how people's midterm races are impacted or may be impacted by the steps that they're taking. Senator Kevin De Leon in California has been instrumental in trying to make sure that the state does enact a strong net neutrality bill. As the EFF describes, the EFF says there's been an outcry from Team Internet in California, making clear how important effective strong net neutrality protections are. Senator De Leon and others are working to make sure that the bill that California eventually passes is actually one that will have teeth. So SB 822 is the bill that needs to be passed by the California legislature and signed by the governor. So that keeps moving forward. And the reason why Senator De Leon is interesting to me at any rate is because he is challenging Senator, this is U.S. Senator Feinstein, in her race in November in California in the fall. Most polls seem to show Feinstein ahead of him, but, you know, young people, I think, are pretty compelled by the net neutrality arguments and maybe coming out and voting for the guy who's very pro strong net neutrality rules will wind up having an impact in November. Any thoughts about this, Sarab?
So I will confess, you know, net neutrality and telecom policy is not my main area of expertise. But one thing that jumped out at me in this debate is that this is being done at the state level, and the extent to which this could conflict with, just by its very nature, conflict with federal regulation, which is extensive, right? The FCC net neutrality rules and the debate that's been going on at the national level. If this is actually going to be done at the state level, it would seem to create the very sort of fragmentation that, for example, we've seen in response to the European Union's general data protection regulation. So mm-hmm. in response to that, countries have been saying, okay, well, we want to carve up our rules to protect local interests, local in the sort of national rather than international sense. And if this is done at the California state level by the state legislature, I'm unsure to what extent it's going to throw a wrench in the larger policy of uniformity that I would imagine we want in U.S. telecommunications. So I'm sort of unsure which way that'll play out, but obviously California, more than most states, has its arms around these issues and you know has a lot of very smart people who can debate these at a high level. So I'm curious to see where it goes.
Yeah, and I think you're right to point out that there will be controversy about states enacting their own net neutrality rules and how well they'll be able to stand up in the face of arguments that the area is the exclusive province of the FCC. Speaking of the FCC and what it can and cannot do, the other net neutrality development that you might want to take note of is the Trump administration has gone to the Supreme Court asking it to review and undo the DC Circuit's 2016 decision that gave the FCC the authority to enact the open internet rules that just recently got undone. So, I mean, that's a pretty convoluted thing that's hard to wrap your head around. But what the Trump administration wants the Supreme Court to do, and the Supreme Court hasn't said whether it will touch this or not yet, is to go in and say, no, not only are the open internet rules gone, which they are, but they never should have been enacted in the first place, because the FCC simply doesn't have the authority to do what it did. That the decision that that said it had that authority was wrongly decided, and Supreme Court, you should come in and say that so it's clear. So it remains to be seen whether the Supreme Court will do that for the time being, and unless and until the Supreme Court does that, there is a federal court of appeals decision from the D.C. Circuit that grants the FCC, or confirms in that court's opinion that the FCC has the authority to do what it did. So that will be an interesting one to watch and see if the Supreme Court decides to get involved. Any thoughts there, Sara?
Yeah, so I think it's important in that case to sort of what kept me oriented as I was parsing the procedural history of this is that the power that the FCC wants is to classify broadband, right? Yes. If the FCC gets to decide what is and is not under this definition, you know, Title I versus Title II of the act that gives it its power, the power to classify and sort of say this set of legal definitions and all the power that comes with it is where we are focusing our attention versus this other legal category. The power to make that determination, if the agency has that, then it's really setting the terms of the debate. And this will ultimately be decided by who the current administration is and you know, sort of what political appointments they have made in terms of commissioners to the FCC. So it's a very politically accountable, politically sensitive process, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. If the argument is that the FCC doesn't have the authority to engage in that kind of classification, then the agency's hands are tied, and the scope of its ability to make politically charged decisions is going to be much more limited. And that's something that, you know, if that's what you want, the court is certainly the authority to ask. So as we were talking about before in the patent system, this too seems fundamentally to me to be a fight about not what the right answer is, but who gets to decide.
And right.
Those are precisely the sorts of questions I think the Supreme Court is best suited for. So whether they take it or not, I don't know. But if anybody should be answering it, it's probably the Supreme Court. And if they decline cert, then I think that at least implicitly be ratifying what the D.C. Circuit had done.
Yes, I agree. And I think it'll be interesting to if we spin this out further and hypothesize that the Supreme Court takes it and decides to undo what the D.C. Circuit did and says, yes, the FCC does not have that authority, then that really punts it back to Congress and once again makes it, you know, all the more political. Congress has so far not done what California is trying to do, enacted its own net neutrality framework, and maybe it would have to decide, you know, based on the interests and wishes of its constituents, whether it's going to go there. And the Supreme Court could put that ball squarely in Congress's court if it takes this case and decides that way. So again, something to watch. And the procedures about net neutrality rules continue to be very interesting to follow and hard to predict. So updating people that those developments happened. Let's move on before we wrap up the show. Just hit a few more topics in, again, just sort of a brief updating kind of way. Let's look real quickly at the social web. So Twitter and other social media platforms are continuing to grapple with how they regulate their platforms, what sort of conduct they expect of users and what they won't tolerate. In the news this week has been Alex Jones and his statement that he wanted his fans to keep their battle rifles ready to do battle with the media, et cetera. Twitter finally pushed Twitter to suspend his account and the InfoWars account temporarily for 7 days. Twitter has been under fire as one social media platform that's been giving Alex Jones and InfoWars more latitude than some of the others. So they did finally take a step this week. And I think that all of these platforms are in a really difficult situation in that they want to, they recognize that they are the de facto public square of our times, and yet they are private companies, and they can control what sort of activity they want to have on the platform or not. So I think that, again, they are trying to think strategically, well, if we don't curtail this kind of conduct, what will Congress or other regulators compel us to do? And by the same token, if we curtail speech that free speech norms in the country indicate that people should have the availability of these platforms to use, then they're worried about having to face regulation on that front as well. So it's just been an interesting week for Twitter, I think, and ongoing. Jack Dorsey has given an interview to the New York Times, I believe it was, saying he's, you know, that everything's on the table, that he's rethinking how Twitter will approach its entire content moderation strategy. So it's a very interesting time for, I think, social media platforms to grapple with these issues. And again, I always like to remind people, because the First Amendment always comes into play in these discussions, that the First Amendment is something that governs how government in one way or another can curtail speech. So for you to say that Twitter has to honor someone's First Amendment rights doesn't really grasp that concept. Instead, what you really mean is Twitter should reflect what our norms are as a country around the fact that we have a First Amendment and we honor speech. So it's, I think, a very difficult tightrope for these platforms to walk. And interesting for them to have to make those decisions. Any thoughts, Sarah?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything you said about the time they have to walk and mm-hmm. you know, curtailing the government censoring people versus private companies mm-hmm. censoring people. Very different. Something that maybe not as much Twitter, although Twitter certainly is at the center of a lot of these issues, but platforms like YouTube and other sort of storage space providers, right? The ability of speakers who use those platforms to disseminate very bandwidth or space intensive content like video. So YouTube is the example that came to mind for that reason. If you can do that freely and without regard to the content of what you're saying, that certainly vindicates free speech norms, but it's also acting as a practical matter like a subsidy, because that's space you can get for free or very cheap over here that you might not otherwise be able to provide for yourself. And you've already got a built-in content distribution network that you're able to leverage through YouTube or any other platform. And so, to the extent that you're not tamping down on people's free speech, like lowercase fs, right? Not the constitutional kind. You're also providing them material benefits that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get, which makes it that much harder for a Twitter or a YouTube or, you know, a different platform to say that we're doing this in a content neutral, value neutral way. We're agnostic about what people say. If you disagree, the cure to bad speech is more speech. But there are these material benefits that come from being on this platform versus that other one. And I think that just makes it that much more complicated and that much more difficult, and at the same time, that much more important to get it right. So I certainly sympathize with the position that they're in, and it's, as you said, a very difficult tightrope to walk.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Stefan?
one of the developments in the past couple of days on the free speech front that I found was interesting, it's a little bit off topic, but I think it strikes at the heart of the matter and it shows the complexity, is the president's decision to remove access to classified documents from former CIA director John Brennan. That seems to me like a more traditional, straightforward constitutional attack on free speech. It doesn't implicate Twitter, doesn't implicate social media per se, but I think it shows that the boundaries of what is and is not a threat to constitutional free speech go beyond what's happening with social media platforms and actually have parameters outside that I think are being ignored. So there's a I think there's a temptation to focus on the corner cases of what's going on in social media where it's not quite in that constitutional realm yet. But I, you know, my jaw is still on the floor from the various op-eds that were published around the John Brennan issue over the past couple of days. So as I think about free speech, that's what I'm thinking about.
Yep. I hear what you're saying. Let us move on. We have an old development and a new development before we get to our concluding material for the show. The old development has to do with copyright. Okay, these guys were asking me before the show, why the heck are you featuring 1998 and 1999 decisions in the rundown today, Denise? And here is why. I was listening to tracks in a Pandora playlist that was very heavy on things from Sting's Brand New Day album, which came out in 1998. And I was having this weird sense memory as I was listening to the tracks, which it was a popular album at the time. But what it brought home to me most viscerally is I not only like this music, but one of the reasons I like this music is because it was the first music, some of the first music I ever enjoyed on an MP3 player. And that was really fun to be able to take tracks to the gym in that little portable format instead of, you know, bolting a big CD player to your arm, which is another thing we used to do back then. The Diamond Rio was the player in question. I think it held like 200 tracks or something. And I definitely had that whole album on there. And it made me remember that in 1998, the RIAA sued Diamond Rio and tried to keep that product from being made available because they argued that it violated the Audio Home Recording Act. And they sought an injunction from further sales of the product. And there was a court opinion that was decided in October of 1998. So we're coming right up on the 20th anniversary of that decision that decided not to grant the injunction. And then it went up to the Ninth Circuit the following year. And the Ninth Circuit decided, yeah, no, this is not violative of the Audio Home Recording Act. So the reason I think it's interesting just to think about those two decisions is how much of what has happened since hinges on the fact that MP3 players were deemed to be legal. We have Apple, who's the first $1 trillion company in the United States. And you remember that, you know, much of that hinges from sales of the iPhone, and that the iPhone famously was the device that could do three things. It was your music library, your camera, and your phone. So it was integral to the entire phone industry, this legal ruling, and integral, of course, to the entire music industry as well, which had to develop legal means of selling digital music and being able to store digital music before it could, you know, evolve to legal downloads and ultimately streaming. So I just think these decisions are really kind of obscure and yet super important to what came next. So I thought they were worth highlighting. Any thoughts, Stefan?
I'll confess that when I saw Diamond Rio, I had to Google it because I couldn't actually remember that product. And what mm-hmm. came up was a Christian country rock band with some really great, also called Diamond Rio, with some really great images. And I thought, this can't be what this is about.
No. Although I bet they stream their music and it was, you know, all as a result of these cases.
I bet they did. I think I always think it's encouraging when courts, take practical considerations into account when making decisions. And even if they're not explicitly reflecting on them in their opinions, when that's the effect. I mean, it would be really unfortunate if a statutory framework that was designed before a technological innovation came around could forever prevent that innovation from developing to its full potential. And I think it's nice to remember these decisions because although this one is in the past, we're seeing similar issues come up all the time where a statutory framework hasn't kept up with technology, and it's always a good opportunity to remind ourselves not to be so stuck in the past and to think about how can we update our legislation to reflect how we live now and to be bold about that so that we can have iPhones and whatever's coming next.
Right. And just to drive home how important this is, we have a tweet in our discussion points for today from John Ehrlichman, who is great about providing you with historical perspective in his tweets. And here he recently tweeted a picture of the very first smartphone. It predates even the Gordon Gecko brick phones. This was the IBM Simon from 1994. And it, I don't think, could have ever been accused of violating the Audio Home Recording Act. So just know that these court decisions helped make the Simon a thing of the past. Sarab, any thoughts?
Yeah, so I, like Stefan, I have a confession to make too. I, until I wound up as a freshman at Georgia Tech, still had my Sony Walkman far longer than it was reasonable to hold on to that thing. But it's funny, I certainly agree that legislation that looks ahead and is updated, by getting industry people and technology experts together in a room to fight, because they're going to have competing priorities, is the way that we need to have an ongoing conversation. Because something else that happened in October of 1998, just as this was this case was being decided, was that Congress enacted and President Clinton signed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is also coming up on its 20th anniversary. And at the time, it was built around a number of assumptions about how the internet would operate, how content providers would operate, and what the competing values at stake were. And that set of assumptions has obviously fallen largely by the wayside. So, to the extent that we're concerned with living in the future and not in the past, it certainly behooves us to reexamine those premises as well.
Right. All right, our final development, I promised you something new, and here it is. So as a blogger in the early days of blogging, I can tell you that and particularly as a blogger who was also a lawyer, lawyers who were blogging back in the day were very excited when there was any sort of evidence that courts knew what blogs were or had heard of blogs or bloggers at all. It gave us some sort of validation to see that ultimately blogs became something that were referenced and then cited, not as precedential authority or anything, but that, they were part of the culture that might be referenced in a court decision. So we have crossed another similar Rubicon. The first poop emoji has appeared in a federal court decision. It was not actually part of the court's analysis, or the court was not using it to express its own thoughts in using the emoji. It was copying a part of the record into its decision. So somebody in the case at a lower court level, it's probably a document that had been exchanged by the parties or referenced by the parties, had a poop emoji in it. But gol darn it, the Seventh Circuit put it in its own opinion. So there is now a poop emoji in a federal court opinion, and you can all rest easy on that front. Any thoughts, Stefan?
When I was in law school, a lot of my classmates and I really enjoyed reading the opinions of a British judge named Lord Denning, because they tended to be pretty funny and kind of pretentious. I'm not sure if you've ever read one of them, but they're kind of classic. I think this belongs up there with anything Lord Denning ever wrote, and I think it may be the greatest opinion that's ever been authored in the history of jurisprudence. So
there we go. High praise. Saurabh?
Not having read it, I'll say that.
Yes.
I concur with my brethren, Stefan. What I love about that passage that the court cited is that the sentence right before the all caps, right, "so glad the arrogance of this employer," etc. This is a PSA for those of you still believing that being a liar brown noser will get you something. So you can already sort of see them building up to the poop emoji. with that rhetoric. So yeah, it's not the Seventh Circuit's own language, but the Seventh Circuit has some of the best writers in the federal judiciary. So maybe someday we'll get there.
Right. And this gives us our second MCLE passphrase for the show, which is going to be precedential poop. Write it down. All right. So we're going to move on to our animal selfie of the week, which comes to us from listener Peter Stark, who wrote to give me the sad news that Coco the gorilla had passed away. So we'll honor Coco and tell you in a moment, because we can't not play our animal selfie bumper for you, why Coco is our animal selfie of the week. So if you are of a certain age, you definitely remember Coco the gorilla. Coco passed away, I guess, this last June at the age of 48, and was a very popular media personality in her own right. She learned to sign using symbols from American Sign Language and graced the cover of National Geographic magazine twice. And the first time Coco was on National Geographic magazine in 1978, as Peter Stark points out, Coco was taking a selfie of herself. She was looking in the mirror with an old SLR camera and taking a picture. So Peter posits that this may well be the very first animal selfie in history. So Coco, we hate to see you go, but we're glad that you could possibly give us the first animal selfie ever. Stefan, what do you think?
I didn't realize gorillas lived this long. This is incredible.
Yep.
Rest in power, Coco.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Our resources of the week are threefold, and they all relate to the topic we mentioned of social media platforms and how they do content moderation, how they decide what speech to allow and what not. So we've got a few different things for you to take a look at on that front if you're interested in those issues and trying to understand them in the way that these companies have to understand them. First of all, we have Charlie Wartzel, if that's how you say his last name. He is the senior tech writer at BuzzFeed. He very obligingly compiled all of his reporting on Twitter harassment and rules issues over the last 2 years into one thread. So we have a link to that thread for you in our discussion points. There is also a video featuring, it's from The Intercept, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Brianna Gray, and Sam Biddle discussing Silicon Valley and speech. So if you want to get into the weeds with them, that's available on YouTube. And then the final really deep, deep dive into this is a piece that was authored last year in March by Kate Klonick. It's called The New Governors, The People, Rules, and Processes Governing Online Speech. It was published in Harvard Law Review. And she really fleshes out this issue in all its detail, really goes into how we have the First Amendment, but it doesn't really apply in this case. So what does that mean to these companies? Here's the end of the synopsis, which I think really sums it up. This article argues that to best understand online speech, we must abandon traditional doctrinal and regulatory analogies and understand these private content platforms as systems of governance. So right back to Lessig with code is law, right? These platforms are now responsible for shaping and allowing participation in our new digital and democratic culture, yet they have little direct accountability to their users. Future intervention, if any, must take into account how and why these platforms regulate online speech in order to strike a balance between preserving the democratizing forces of the internet and protecting the generative power of our new governors, the social media platforms. So really compelling look at that. And in fact, we've reached out to Kate Klonick and hope to get her on the show in the very near future. So we hope that that works out too. We have a tip of the week for you that is a little bit more lighthearted. And I'm not sure, you may only be able to participate and take advantage of this tip if you are a Donald Trump campaign supporter. But our tip is that there are Space Force logos that are under consideration and available to be voted on if you have a favorite. The way we know this is the Trump Political Action Committee sent out emails to, I think, past donors that enabled them to pick a favorite and vote. So I've been looking for a way that anybody else could do so as well. Haven't stumbled on that yet. If anyone finds it, do let me know. I know I would love to weigh in on the new Space Force logo, and as I'm sure we all would. But if you'd like to take a look at them, the email has circulated and gone to the press. So there are six logos that apparently are under consideration. Do you have a favorite, Stefan?
I'm going to say, none of these hold a candle to what the Soviets could have come up with. If you want, stellar aesthetics, in particular when it comes to anything involving technology, you got to go to, 1930s Moscow. And sorry, with all due respect to the Trump administration, this is amateur work at best. And I'm sure your Congressman Dana would agree, given his history. So.
Yes, IRC has been discussing his history throughout the show. Do you have a favorite, Sarah?
I don't, but having learned the lessons of Her Majesty's government, I think Spacey McSpaceface might be something that, that didn't get the consideration it deserved.
Yeah, Spacey McSpaceface. I kind of like the Mars Awaits one, but I feel like it's got a short shelf life because once we go to Mars, it will no longer be awaiting. So anyway, thought you would all enjoy the logos, not half as much as I have enjoyed this discussion today and getting together with you, Sarab. Great to have you back on the show. Really appreciate all your insights and elucidation on our complicated patent structure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great to come back.
Is there anything going on with your scholarship or events at Texas A&M that you'd like to let people know about before we sign off today?
Absolutely. So I'm actually only one of a number of IP professors, intellectual property professors at Texas A&M, and we have an annual IP Scholars Roundtable that's this October, and we actually have it twice a year, so there's another one coming up in April. But the Center for Law and Intellectual Property, CLIP, at Texas A&M is always hosting events, not just for academics and other professors, but for the public and for practitioners, people who want to learn more about the system. I encourage you to reach out to us, including me personally. I'd love to hear from you. And so that's what we've got on track for the fall.
Great. Thank you so much for that and for joining us today.
Thanks again.
Stefan Schweide, great to have you on board as co-host. I'm very excited about this.
As am I. I'm thrilled to be here. And I look forward to you bringing me back down to earth when the celebrity status just inflates me and I go up into space.
I've been noodling over how my longtime co-host Evan Brown and I were sort of the Stacey and Clinton of This Week in Law from What Not to Wear. I've been trying to decide what Mike Keyes and I were. I think we're more like Jerry and Elaine from Seinfeld. So it's up to us to chart our course, Stefan. I'm not
all
sure.
Right.
Not sure what dynamic duo we will wind up being, but give it some thought. we'll have to see what our audience thinks as well. But I'm thrilled to have you. You have an official twit.tv email now. I don't know if we've communicated that to you yet, but you're Stefan at twit.tv. So anyone who wants to get in touch with us between the shows, you can email Stefan, Stefan at twit.tv. It's S-T-E-F-A-N. And I'm Denise at twit.tv. Please let us know what's on your mind, what other wonderful folks out there in the world you think we would benefit from inviting on the show. And again, I'm not shy. I'll invite anybody. All they can do is say no. I don't take it personally. So let us know who are your dreamed guests for us. We'd love to reach out to them. Topics, too, if you want to hear more about certain issues, if you want to hear something explained in detail, or if you just find funny or interesting things in your own journeys around the web, shoot them our way, please. We're also on Twitter. I am anyway. Stefan, you're not a very active Twitterer, are you?
I was actually trying to register just before we got on today so that I can have a platform devoted to this and not have that ghost Twitter account that I have out there. So not active yet, but I'm going to dip my toe in soon.
All right. Keep us posted. I'm Dee Howell over there. You can also find us on Facebook and on Google+. Just let us know in any of those forums what's on your mind. We love hearing from you. And, obviously learning things like what could be the first animal selfie of the week or the first animal selfie ever taken to be our animal selfie of the week. We couldn't do this show without the great feedback that all of you give us. So please keep it coming. What else should I tell you? We do the show on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when you can join us live if you're inclined to do so. Always fun to jump into IRC with everyone who is playing along with us as we record the show. But if you can't, don't worry about it. Head on over to twit.tv/twill. Whole archive of shows is there going back to the inception, not quite back to Diamond Rio days, but throwing it back hard there to 2006 is when we started the show. So definitely take advantage of that. Take advantage of suggestions as to how you can enjoy the show, whether you prefer to kick back and watch it on your big screen TV, small screen TV, small screen phone, whatever. You can subscribe and enjoy the show on any platform of your choice. Let us know on those platforms too. Many of them will give you the opportunity to rate or comment there. We definitely appreciate your feedback in any and all of those forms. So until next week, please take care.